From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Raby, sitting in for John Horn. On today's show, what's next for Hollywood after the Me Too reckoning? Maybe Pay Up Hollywood, which focuses on the way the industry treats assistants. Then Taika Waititi, director of the new anti-hate satire Jojo Rabbit, responds to critics who say he shouldn't make fun of the Third Reich.
In America, people see the word divisive. It's a very negative thing. I know that if I wanted to have pleased every single person with this film, it would not be this film, and it would not be one of my films. It would be someone else's film, and it would be boring.
All that coming up on The Frame. This is The Frame. I'm John Raby. Recently on the podcast, Script Notes, Aladdin screenwriter John August and Chernobyl creator Craig Mazin took on one of Hollywood's open secrets, the way it treats assistants, the workers who will do anything to get their foot in the door. Here's Script Notes producer Meghna Rao reading a message from a talent manager's assistant who makes $15 an hour.
That is after renegotiating it up after a year of working here. This is while I have to listen to him making deals for his clients for hundreds of thousands of dollars from their jobs, jobs that I submit them for.
On their podcast, August and Mazin asked people to tweet their horror stories, and one of the people who took them up on it was Liz Alper, a TV writer and Writers Guild board member. She came up with the hashtag PayUpHollywood, and she joins us now. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Hi, John.
Give our listeners a sense of what assistant can cover in Hollywood.
Oh, assistant can cover any entry-level job into any aspect of the industry. Every department on any sort of production will have assistants working for them. So there is an entire generation of Hollywood up-and-comers who are working these entry-level jobs right now.
I want to talk about some of the response you got to your tweet. What were the horror stories people were telling you?
Some of them are making $12 an hour. There have been a lot of stories where people have said, I will normally work anywhere between 60 and 80 hours a week, but because my company refuses to pay me overtime, I'm not being paid for the work that I'm doing. There are stories of assistants who've had to go searching all over Beverly Hills to find their boss's car because their boss left their Porsche somewhere and don't know exactly where they left it. And on top of that, they're managing financial information for that boss's clients, and they're being paid $12 an hour without benefits.
Yeah, and I can hear a lot of listeners at the start of our conversation saying, well, when you're a kid, you're supposed to suffer a little bit in your first job, and then you move out of it. But these are people who are no longer just fresh out of college.
Exactly. And not only that, but there's a difference between having to suffer a little bit and being completely unable to take a position because financially you will not be able to support yourself on the salary that they are offering. You shouldn't have to choose between pursuing a passion and making a living. And right now, the wage discrepancies in Hollywood are making it so that people who are financially well off are the only ones who can survive taking these jobs. So this message of inclusion that Hollywood wants to promote, it's actually being nixed at the entry level. This is just one more roadblock for diversity to actually break in and make a difference in the industry.
We're talking with Liz Alper here on The Frame. She's the creator of hashtag PayUpHollywood. Hollywood's been talking a lot about diversity. What does the way it treats assistants say about their commitment to it?
I think it's much easier to overlook inclusion and diversity when those roles are not necessarily gaining you PR. Especially in the assistant community, we are fast approaching a time where only candidates from wealthy backgrounds will be able to sustain themselves on the salaries being offered. And so we are looking at what I've been calling a homogenized Hollywood, where the next generation of Hollywood execs that make their way up from assistants all come from the same wealthy, usually white backgrounds. The best way that we can make sure that we are promoting inclusion and diversity in Hollywood and making sure that we have diversity at the top in the highest ranks of Hollywood is by growing it at the bottom. And the only way that we can do that is make sure that we are leveling out the playing field. And anyone who doesn't believe that low wages and breaking into Hollywood is slowly becoming a socioeconomic issue doesn't realize how many assistants who come here already come from wealthy backgrounds because they're the only ones who can live on the paltry salaries that assistants are making nowadays.
It sounds like what you're saying, too, is that this is not just a moral question, but it's also a legal question. If we have people working unpaid overtime, for instance.
Sure. I think that's the issue. It's a huge open secret in Hollywood. The examples that have been given outright have said, we were asked to do something illegal, and yes, everybody knew about it, and yes, everybody was okay with us being asked to do it so that budgets could remain low.
Why can Hollywood get away with the way it treats assistants?
I think because there's this culture of you should be grateful for what you get. We are told that if we don't want the job, someone else will. Everybody wants to make it in Hollywood. Everybody wants to break in, and we all know how hard it is to get your foot in the door. So from the very beginning, you are told if you don't want this job, there are thousands of people who are just waiting to get their foot in the door.
You've been getting tons of tweets. I know there have been lots of responses to the podcast script notes. Is anybody laying out a strategy to change this?
I don't want to speak to anything just yet. We are talking about things in the infantile stages. But until there's anything concrete, I'd rather refrain from speaking.
Can you say in general what it would take to change this?
We need to be able to sustain this movement. It's going to require addressing reality. It's going to take policy solutions that are specific to this industry, but ultimately it's going to take allies and advocates from every part of the industry getting together and saying, let's find a solution so across the board, entry-level positions are sustainable for the next generation of Hollywood up-and-comers. It's going to take everybody coming together and saying this has to change.
That's Liz Alper, TV writer and producer and creator of hashtag PayUpHollywood. Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, John.
Coming up next on The Frame, filmmaker Taika Waititi's new movie is about a German boy whose imaginary friend is Adolf Hitler. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Raby, sitting in for John Horn. New Zealand director Taika Waititi is peculiar. He made the blockbuster Thor Ragnarok, but he's also made quirky tales like What We Do in the Shadows, a comedy about a group of vampires who struggle with the banality of everyday life. In his new film, Jojo Rabbit, which he adapted the screenplay for and directed, Waititi plays Adolf Hitler as the imaginary friend of a young boy living under the Third Reich. He told John Horn the idea came from his mom telling him about a novel she'd read called Caging Skies.
Something about the way she described it, I think she was trying to explain to me what it was like for the boy in the book, and she was describing it in a way where she was saying that this boy had never met a Jew before, and all he knew about Jews were from propaganda and from those horrible kids' books that they put out, you know, with all these horrible pictures of them and comparing them to rats and demons and things. And so what she was saying is that for him it was like having a monster in the house, in the attic. You know, like it was like having this thing up there. And for me it felt, oh, that sort of lent itself a little bit towards like Let the Right One In or something. And so I thought, oh, there's this element there that could be quite amazing to explore, this idea of the enemy being this Jewish girl and, you know, just totally disrupting this kid's perfect life.
I want to read a passage from Caging Skies by Christine Lunens that your film is loosely based on. And this is Jojo talking about himself. If it's true, I tried to get the young woman off my mind. By that time, I was also trying to get Adolf Hitler off it. His constant reproach about my shortcomings irked me. My incapability, indecorum, infidelity, all starting within and ejecting me out of his good opinion. That's probably the only vague reference to this boy hearing Hitler speaking to him. You take that to a much higher level. At what point did you figure out that that was something you could seize on, and what did it give you in terms of telling the story?
I don't know. I wasn't really interested in making a World War II film. And as important as they are, it's just not really my style. And I just wanted to continue to try and make something that was more true to me. And that's where this idea of an imaginary friend who's giving him terrible advice throughout the film came from.
Poor Jojo. What's wrong, little man?
Hi, Adolf.
Want to tell me about that rabbit incident? What was all that about?
They wanted me to kill it. I'm sorry. I couldn't.
Don't worry about it. I couldn't care less.
But now they call me a scared rabbit.
Let them say whatever they want. People used to say a lot of nasty things about me. Oh, this guy's a lunatic. Oh, look at that psycho. He's gonna get us all killed. I'll let you in on a little secret. The rabbit is no coward.
It was interesting because it's not Hitler. It's probably some sort of amalgam of his father and Hitler and maybe some other father figures that he wanted in his life. And so that's really where that came from. And I wanted a best friend that was striking and really represented the Reich. And I wanted to show that throughout the film, you know, if you look carefully, like, you know, the buttons are falling off his jacket and his hair slowly gets more messy and, you know, sleeves start falling off on his jacket, which mirrors, you know, the fall of the Third Reich and, you know, and the complete and utter shambles that it became.
And at this point, when you're first thinking about it, you haven't made Hunt for Wilder People, correct?
No. Nope.
But you've made Boy.
Yep, I have not made What We Do in the Shadows.
Okay, but you have been thinking about and at least made one movie about underparented or unparented kids, which seems pretty clearly to be something that you're struck by.
Yeah.
And Cajun Skies, the novel, and Jojo Rabbit, the movie, seem to fall pretty neatly into that idea.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what is it about that idea that you find interesting?
Well, I think some people would suggest that it's a focus more on children and father figures. But it's, I feel like it's, most of my films are really about mothers. Boy is really about a boy and his longing for his mother and trying to convince himself that, you know, that his father's this fantastical person and that, you know, that's really who he wants in his life when it's not. Very similar with Thor. See those elements in Thor. It's all about family, and I love the family dynamic. And so growing up with a single mother, I was like fascinated with what our dads would be up to, or like, you know, what were their backgrounds and stuff, even though I knew my dad. But I grew up in an area with there were a lot of solo mums and a lot of kids from, you know, with single parent homes. And so it's all I knew, actually. And we would actually roll around and little groups and hassle kids if we found out that their parents were still together, because it just wasn't cool to have two parents, not in my neighborhood. And so that was all I've ever really known. And like, I feel like the times I've tried to write families with two parents, I sort of get pretty bored. I don't know how to really do it. And yeah, they say write what you know. So I always like kill off one of the parents or get rid of one. But I do think it's about those relationships and families is really what most of my films are dealing with.
We're talking with Taika Waititi about his new film, Jojo Rabbit. Tone is so critical to this movie. And I was thinking about this documentary called The Last Laugh. And I don't know if you know about it. It's about comedy and the difference between what you can say about Nazis versus what you can say about the Holocaust. And Fern Perlstein is the filmmaker, and here's what she had to say about this. You can make fun of the perpetrators, you can make fun of the Nazis, but you can't make fun of the victims or the camps. That's what many people think. And I'm wondering, as you are trying to figure out tonally, how far is too far, and how far you need to go, how do you know when you've struck that right balance? And well, what is off-limits, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree with that, that sentiment. It's not anything I would have ever even entertained, really, when I was writing this. It's nothing. There was no way that I was going to make this completely two-sided and, you know, and poke in, like, say, well, you know, make some sort of, you know, quips about, you know, about the Jews or about any of the atrocities. It was, first and foremost, and it still is, an attempt to talk about prejudice and intolerance and really behind all of it, the way that children see grown-ups' behavior in the world, and not only just day-to-day stuff, but especially during conflicts, because I feel like, and this, I am a father of two children, and since that happened, I've become very acutely aware of my behavior around children and around my children, and seeing, you know, and how they see me, and you know, I'm supposed to be this a strong, resilient, guiding light for them, who's going to guide them through the world, and you know, and I make their lunch for them, and I drop them off to school, and I'm very reliable. You know, and there are times that I've been dropping them off to school late, and I'm not reliable, and they, you know, and little by little, you know, I keep thinking that, well, eventually, you know, if your behavior gets too absurd and crazy, like some adults' behavior, children stop believing in this idea of hope, and or they stop believing in human beings, and they stop believing in the balance of the world, because, and then especially in war, these reliable mentors who are guiding children through the world, because we're responsible and we're smart, what do they think when they see us fighting wars and blowing each other up and shooting each other in the head and killing each other and acting like, you know, crazed animals? It can't be good.
I'm going to ask you about history. You've lived in Berlin, and I have been to Berlin, and the way that Germany and that city in particular have addressed the Holocaust is, I would say, relatively admirable.
Yeah.
There are museums like the Holocaust Museum. There's a Topography of Terror. There's Memorial to the Murdered Jews. There are massive public installations and museums dedicated to what this country did. And mm-hmm. if you think about American slavery, not quite up to that same level. Mm-hmm. And you lived in Berlin. I want to come to this broader idea about not forgetting history and a generation of people, including moviegoers, that either don't understand or don't really know what happened during the war and how a fictional story like JoJo can fit into that part of history and storytelling.
Yeah. Well, I would say the only real fictional part of this film is this imaginary friend, Hitler. The rest of it I'd researched a lot, and you know, Christine also did a lot of research for her book. At the end of that war, you know, what was the First World War was the one to end all wars. Ironically, there was another really, really big one. But at the end of the Second World War, you know, everyone thought, well, we've learned our lesson. Okay, let's stop fighting. You know, that involved every country almost. And now we'll be grown-ups again and we'll, you know, we'll sort out our differences. And then within a few years, there was another one and then another one. And I tried to look and I tried to see how many conflicts there were since World War II, and I gave up because there were hundreds. And so, no, we haven't learned anything. That's the point in telling these stories. You have to keep telling these stories in order to keep teaching ourselves and to keep teaching younger audiences the difference between right and wrong and love and hate. And that particular story is worth retelling because it is very powerful and it's very memorable, and it's and some of those people are still alive. So that's why it's vital, I think, to keep having the discussion and keep talking and having a conversation, because otherwise if we don't watch out, we will forget. Then we're doomed to repeat.
Coming up on The Frame, more with filmmaker Taika Waititi. He tells John Horn he knows not everybody will enjoy a comedic satire about Nazis, but he also doesn't care. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Raby, sitting in for John Horn. In the new film Jojo Rabbit, Scarlett Johansson plays the mother of a young boy who counts Adolf Hitler as an imaginary friend.
We will crush our enemies into dust, and when they are destroyed, we shall use their graves as toilets.
Okay, no more politics. Dinner is neutral ground. This table is Switzerland. Let's eat.
Filmmaker Taika Waititi, who directed Jojo and also plays the dreamed-up Hitler, says Roman Griffin Davis, who plays the 10-year-old boy, teared up when he first saw him in costume as the dictator. And Waititi told John Horn that wasn't the only hard part of making a dark comedy about the Third Reich.
The novel upon which this film is based was published more than a decade ago, and you've been working on this film for a number of years. What kept you going, and how did you finally get it made? What changed? Was it something that happened in your career? Something happened
between the first drafts?
Yeah, because a lot of people must have said, I'll use a euphemism, no, to what they told you when you started chopping it around.
Yeah, there was a lot of enthusiasm for the script because it is a good script. But, however, even then I knew it was a hard film for people to make. And not only because of this, you know, the humor element to it, but it's another World War II film. And like, I think at that time, 2011, there'd been a lot. And also at that time, it was a period where the industry was focused more on actors being the selling point of films, and that they, to get the money, to get financing for a film like this, would need, you know, big names, very, very big names. And I think that if anyone big had played this role, had played Hitler, it would have really distracted from the whole point of the film and the message of the film and the story, which is these kids and like their story. And it would have just become the insert name here, Hitler movie.
If I had visited the set, I can imagine you've got these cities that are decorated with swastikas and other Nazi propaganda. But what about dressing these towns with Nazi imagery?
Yeah.
How do you go about telling the locals what you're up to? Because it would be incredibly upsetting for anybody, especially people in that part of Europe.
Yeah. Well, it's not nice. It's not something you're proud of, but, you know, if you want to tell these stories, you've got to do it. And, well, it's interesting, the town that we where we had the gallows and, you know, we had all those flags along the streets, that very square was a place where Hitler did a rally. And so he'd been there, and those, you know, so a lot of those banners would have been there. And, you know, you could see some old people, like, looking and seeing the stuff, and someone I think did say, oh, I remember this, you know, in passing, which again is, I mean, it's a very chilling thing to see, especially, you know, even though it's a movie, and we're, you know, it's very unnerving, and also obviously to be dressed as Hitler, and you know, it's not that I'd wander around. We would close off a lot of the streets so that where we were shooting wasn't accessible to the public, so All the streets leading into the squares and stuff were off limits, but yeah, it's not a nice thing to catch a glimpse of your reflection when you're dressed like that, or if you've got that moustache on, which he ruined for everyone, I will like to point out.
Even if you haven't read reviews that came out of Toronto, this film is very polarizing, and people have very strong opinions to the positive and to the negative. And I guess given the material that's expected, did you always kind of know that going in, that there are going to be people who would embrace this film and people who would reject it?
Yeah, I always knew there were people who embraced the film and they would be racist.
And it's either or.
No, I mean, it's in America, people see the word divisive. They see it as a very negative thing or polarizing. For the rest of us, feel like it's actually quite a worthwhile thing to have put upon whatever piece of art you're making. I know that if I wanted to have pleased every single person with this film, it would not be this film, and it would not be one of my films. It would be someone else's film, and it would be boring. But yeah, no, I always knew that there would be people who would not be in it, and fair enough. It is a hard subject matter to deal with, and especially if it's something that's very close to you. I did read somewhere someone said something like, oh, I don't think we're ready for humor with the subject matter, which is insane to me. I mean, there was one movie in 1939 which did it, and
The Great Dictator?
Yeah, so it's Charlie not a Chaplin. New it's not a new idea. And I think what's interesting is like this idea that, oh, humor can't be used in a serious way, or it can't be used to fight against regimes and dictators, which is actually one of the most powerful tools that's ever been used. So I feel like I'm in very good company.
Taika, great to see you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Jojo Rabbit, directed by and starring Taika Waititi, opens in Los Angeles and New York Friday, October 18. And that's all for today. I'm John Raby at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. The Frame is back tomorrow.